For the rest of the hour, a look at the financial relationships between universities and private companies. Next time you're sitting in the doctor's office and, you know, and that's in your socks and your paper gown, take a look around the exam room. Did you ever notice how much stuff comes from pharmaceutical companies? There's a plastic tissue box holder courtesy of one drug company. There's a pen touting the latest diabetes drug. There's a poster explaining heart disease brought to you by the maker of a blockbuster statin drug. The drug companies give a lot of gifts, and a lot of them are given to doctors. Your doctor may even buy lunch for his whole staff, courtesy of a pharmaceutical company. He or she may speak at a local gathering of doctors with compensation by the same folks. The drug companies, the medical device makers, also pay for a lot of research, and a lot of that research is done at universities and medical colleges. According to a new report out this week in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, at least 60% of med school department heads surveyed report receiving some money from drug companies for everything from research to speaking fees to payment for sitting on a board. Is it possible that all that money exchanging hands might influence the research that's being done? Who's making sure that patients and science don't suffer? That's what we'll be talking about this hour. Our number 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guests. Daniel S. Greenberg is a science journalist who has written extensively about politics and business of science. His new book is Science for Sale, The Perils, Rewards, and the Delusions of Campus Capitalism. He joins us from our NPR studios in Washington. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dan.
Hi, Ira.
Hi there. Also along with us in Washington is Marjorie Powell. She is a senior assistant general counsel for the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. You know them as PhRMA. Welcome to Science Friday, Ms. Powell.
Ira, it's nice to be here.
Thank you. Eric Campbell is a senior scientist at the Institute for Health Policy at Mass General. He's also an associate professor of health policy at Mass General and Harvard Med School. He joins us from WBUR in Boston. Thank you for being with us today, Dr. Campbell.
Good afternoon, Ira.
You're welcome. Dr. David Korn is a senior vice president for biomedical and health sciences research at the Association of American Medical Colleges in Washington. He joins us from WRNI in Providence, Rhode Island. Thanks for talking with us today, Dr. Korn.
Good afternoon.
We're going to take a break. Stay with us. We'll get back to you all, talk about this important subject. Take your phone calls, 1-800-989-8255. Stay with us. If you've got questions about doctors and funding of medical research, we'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about medical research and the connection to universities and the money that flows between and the independence of doctors and researchers and how all that is playing out with my guest, Daniel Greenberg, author of Science for Sale, The Perils, Rewards, and Delusions of Campus Capitalism, Marjorie Powell, who's Senior Assistant Attorney General Counsel for PhRMA, Eric Campbell of Harvard Med School, and David Korn of the Association of American Medical Colleges. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Dan, can you lay out for us, so universities get money from private companies to do research, so what's the problem here?
Ira, there's a mix of institutions and goals that's bound to create conflict and concerns, and they certainly have. Universities are eager for industry money, but they're wary about losing intellectual property, and they're also concerned about restrictions on publication, which industry sometimes insists upon when it gives universities money for research. Industry wants academic scientists for their output and for marketing purposes. Journals seeking the hot papers that bring in the readers, that bring in the advertising, are another part of the mix here. And sometimes they're not as careful as they should be in looking at the papers that are submitted for publication. Mm-hmm. And the government agencies responsible for ensuring integrity in scientific research and protection of the public are reluctant or ambivalent about cracking down on corner cutting in the conduct of research and the protection of volunteers in medical research. Meanwhile, the public feels betrayed when scientists stray, and the scientific community worries that ethical lapses will erode political support and grants. Maybe not all the ingredients necessary for the perfect storm, but certainly plenty of ingredients for a lot of trouble, and we've seen a good deal of it in recent years.
Are you saying that the science that comes out of these relationships and interactions is not good science?
Oh, a lot of it is very, very good science, but a lot of it involves some corner cutting, and in particular, lack of proper protections for volunteers who are participating in clinical trials. Mm-hmm. Another factor that we have is that pharmaceutical companies have been moving the clinical trials offshore, where they are cheaper, and one might believe that FDA scrutiny isn't as intense as it might be in this country. Mm-hmm. So there are concerns about the quality of the science coming out.
You know, when we talk about science, supposedly the independence of it, we talk sometimes to pollsters in the political season, and I say if polling is a science, how do we have a Republican pollster get one product that comes out and a different conclusion by the Democratic pollsters? And then I look at an article. I saw an article in April a year ago in the Washington Post talking about a schizophrenia drug test. And it says, comparison of schizophrenia drugs often favors the firm funding the study. They get different results from whoever does the study. It seems like the same polling question.
Well, Eric Campbell and his colleagues have done quite a few good studies. They really are kind of landmark studies about the relationship between the funding of a clinical trial and the outcome. And in general, it seems to be that the funder will get a much more favorable response in many of these trials. Mm-hmm. So that's another ground for concern.
Mm-hmm. Let me get some reaction from our other guests. Marjorie Powell, how do you react to these accusations?
Well, all of science is small steps forward, and every study has problems that could be fixed by the next study. That's one of the things we've learned through years and years of scientific development. I think it's fair to say that there are FDA regulations, there are NIH regulations that guide the development of clinical trials, and every institution that is doing clinical trials has an institutional review board that is focused solely on protection of the human subjects in that trial. Those review boards have an independent role so I think patients should not worry about the issue of participating in a trial. It's also true that the FDA requires multiple clinical trial sites so that they can look at information across different, either academic or physician in practice, clinical investigators. And they also require multiple trials for many, many drugs. So I don't think patients should be worried about the quality of the research going into those studies. Now, it is true that there is always a small number of investigators who may have difficulties complying with the requirements or following standard scientific procedures. But there are systems in place within the academic medical centers, the universities, to pay attention to those kinds of concerns.
Mm-hmm. Eric Campbell, are you satisfied that there's enough of a hands-off policy between drug companies who fund the research that the universities do to keep them independent and to not skew the results?
Well, at first, I agree with Dan. I think there have been a lot of studies done that have looked at the nature of the relationship between the outcome of a study and the funder. And the research overwhelmingly shows that studies that are funded by companies are significantly more likely to yield pro-industry results than studies that are not funded by companies. There are some reasons for that. Those studies may be designed differently. They may be conducted in different ways. So we really don't know about the overall safety and efficacy of those trials. But I will say, the IRBs are not necessarily as independent.
IRB?
The institutional review boards. They're the boards that oversee clinical research. We published a study in New England Journal earlier this year where we showed that the majority of IRB members actually have some form of relationship with companies as well. So the people that are sitting on the boards who are supposed to be overseeing actually have relationships themselves. Mm-hmm. And just to put this in perspective, it's medical students have relationships. Faculty members who do the research have relationships. Department chairs who oversee the departments in which they work have relationships. The people who serve on the IRB boards have relationships, and they're frequent. So the level of independence one could really question.
Well, what about Marjorie Powell saying that, you know, the FDA says it's okay?
Well, I'm not going to comment on the overall ability of the FDA to manage this. I will note that the FDA has recently tightened up the nature of the relationships that people who serve on their committees to approve drugs can have. And, in fact, they still can be people who serve on committees who have relationships with drug companies. And these are the people that are making the decisions about the overall, if you will, efficacy and safety of drugs entering the market.
Mm-hmm. Ira, this is Marjorie. Can I jump in on that? Because, in fact, the advisory boards provide advice to FDA, but the decision about whether a product can be approved and what uses it can be approved for what patient population remains with the scientists and medical officers at the FDA.
So why have the advisory boards if the FDA scientists can just override them?
Well, in many instances, the FDA establishes an advisory board or submits information to an advisory board because they have a particular scientific question that they would like to get some broader advice about. Sometimes that's for a specific drug. Sometimes it's for a class of drugs.
Well, my question was, why have the advisory board at all if the FDA, as you say, doesn't have to listen to them?
Well, the advisory board is providing them with scientific advice that the FDA decision makers are going to be listening to, but the authority isn't transferred from the FDA to the advisory board to make the approval decision.
David Korn, you want to ring in on this? I mean, from what I understand, you would like the government to keep hands off of any kind of regulation of this process. Is that right?
No, I think there is an established set of regulations that come from the Public Health Service through an agency that is specifically charged, for example, with the protection of human beings who participate in medical research. You know, we've covered a lot of ground here in the last 10 minutes, and I think I'd like to just make a couple of suggestions. One of them is that guilt by association is easy to infer, at least. And I think we have to be careful that we don't tar people because they have financial relationships with industry as something that's necessarily wrong. For example, let me explain what I mean. This country supports biomedical research more generously than any other country in the world. The budget of the National Institutes of Health is somewhere between $28 and $29 billion. The public support for biomedical research is not because the average citizen is interested in furthering biomedical knowledge. It's because they all have experience with disease, and they are very much interested in finding ways of preventing, treating, and curing disease. Mm-hmm. The only way in our society that can happen is for relationships between those who discover new knowledge, in this case, let's say academic medical scientists, and the organizations that our society has created to translate that knowledge into human benefit, to determine how a discovery like the one you just talked to with the gentleman from Stanford, whether that can and cannot be developed into something that will be of human benefit. So the existence of relationships is not surprising. I think it would be mm-hmm. astonishing were there not these relationships.
I understand. You know, one question, a peripheral question that you raise is, you said that the NIH funds about $30 billion worth of research. Did I hear you that correctly?
It's somewhere between $28 and $29 billion.
And people wonder, if they're funding so much of this medical research, why the public is still paying $5 to $10 a pill for something that comes out of the money that they spent on this publicly funded research.
Actually,
or why there may be tests that cost $200 or $300 that they're being charged for money that comes out of this publicly funded research.
Ira, this is Marjorie. Let me jump in on that issue because I think it's important to remember that the NIH funding is spread across a lot of basic medical research. For example, when Dr. Weiss-Corray was talking about his Alzheimer's research, that's the kind of research that NIH would fund, or perhaps even more basic mm-hmm. medical studies. And then at some point, the pharmaceutical industry builds upon that research to both research and then develop a medicine. NIH
do they pay NIH back for the money that NIH spent on it?
In most instances, NIH research doesn't actually get to the point of finding a compound that would be studied and potentially developed to become a new medicine.
But if NIH sunk $5 or $10 million into their basic research, does pharma pay back NIH for that kind of money, even though they've used the common knowledge that's generated from it?
The federal requirement is that institutions that receive NIH funding are supposed to try and find ways to turn that into commercial development. So they have an obligation to find companies, be they drug or device companies or other high-tech companies, to take their knowledge and turn it into productive uses for the public.
Mm-hmm. I have to give an idea. We're talking about government funding, medicines, a whole gamut this hour, and talk of the Nation of Science Friday from NPR News. Let me go back to you, Dan. You've been sitting and listening. Is there a way? We've heard David Korn say that this is probably the best way to do this, and there's probably no other way of having a government and industry cooperation, university and corporate cooperation. Is there any other possible way?
Well, I think, first of all, Ira, we should not take at face value many of these federal and institutional structures that have been put in place to ensure the integrity of science in relation to helping the public. Institutional review boards, which are responsible for assuring the safety of volunteers in medical experiments, have repeatedly been found to be kind of rubber stamp operations at universities. There are serious efforts underway to improve their performance, but nobody thinks the performance is really very strong. And furthermore, you know, the pharmaceutical industry has been involved in many episodes that have led many, many people to be very wary of its assertions about commitment to the public interest. Consider the Vioxx trials. The lead author of one of the basic papers told the New York Times that Merck wrote the paper and then asked him to edit it. He never heard about a woman dying in the trial until later on. And Merck has lawsuits all over the country from families of Vioxx patients. Some say thousands died from using the drug. The structures were in place to assure that this didn't happen. Nonetheless, it did. So I think we should be a little bit wary about saying everything is okay and the relationships are fine and they're properly regulated, because, in fact, they're not.
When did all of this change? You give a quote in your book, about when industry and academia became so entwined. You quote Jonas Salk about the polio vaccine saying, quote, "There is no patent. Could you patent the sun?"
Well, I don't know whether you can patent the sun, but I'm pretty sure if somebody could make money from it today, they would try very hard. It really all began with the biotechnology revolution around 1980 or in the late 70s, and then the passage of the Bayh-Dole Act, which is a little-known but very, very important law that governs economic activities in universities that receive federal research money. The law says that any university that receives federal research money must disclose any research findings that may have commercial value and then must pursue patents and try to find some commercial operation that will produce the goods. Universities don't make pills. They produce knowledge. So they have to go outside to existing companies, or in many instances, they will start spin-offs. That is, companies usually headed by a professor on their faculty, often the scientists who are involved in the discovery. And that's where it took off from. The odd fact is that the biotechnology industry, of which we hear so much, has been described by one of its leaders as the greatest money-losing industry in the history of the world. It has been living on equity, and the sales don't come anywhere near the amount of money that's been invested. That's just a sidelight. about the biotechnology industry. And as far as the number of drugs reaching the public, well, perhaps it's very early in the development of these drugs, but so far they are relatively few.
All right, we're going to have to take a short break. We'll come back and talk lots more about the relationship between pharmaceutical industry and academic research and doctors. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Perhaps you're in the medical field. Maybe you're a doctor or a drug representative, or you want to chime in on the discussion going on today. We invite you. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Also, you can go to Second Life. We have science school going there. We're look for the folks wearing the Science Friday T-shirts over there and pick up a T-shirt and get to ask a question. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about medical research and the interaction between the pharmaceutical companies and academics and doctors with my guests, David Korn, Senior Vice President at the Association of American Medical Colleges, Eric Campbell, who is Senior Scientist at the Institute for Health Policy at Mass General. Also with us is Marjorie Powell, Senior Assistant General Counsel for Pharma. Daniel Greenberg, author of Science for Sale, The Perils, Rewards, and Delusions of Campus Capitalism. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. David Korn, if the drug companies pay a university to do research, should it be a requirement that the university own the intellectual property, own the data that comes out? Wouldn't that eliminate some of the squabbling over, you know, where the money goes?
I would like to answer that, Ira, by saying that I think less than the issue of owning the data is the issue of accountability of those university faculty who are playing any sort of significant role in a particular study, whether it's funded by the NIH or by a foundation or the industry or anyone else. And I agree that there have been instances of ghost authorship. That is, putting people's names on papers when those people have not, in fact, had full responsibility nor full accountability for the research. The association at which I'm now working strongly condemns ghost authorship of any kind.
When you say ghost authorship, are you saying that it has the name of one person on it, but it was written by someone else?
I'm saying that people
give me for example. Give me for example. Give me a fact.
I think Dan Greenberg gave you one example a moment ago about a particular paper relating to Vioxx where the first named author, apparently, from what we know, did not have much of a role in the actual design or conduct or interpretation of experimental data, but did perhaps help write the paper and certainly helped get the paper into a front-rank medical journal. That kind of practice, we believe at the association, is deplorable. It's an affront to academic ethics, and it should cease.
And Ira, Marjorie, we at Pharma also believe that that's inappropriate, and we have established a set of principles that our companies adhere to that say that that govern all of the relationships between researchers and the final authors of papers. And we feel very strongly that the authors of papers should be part of the research. They should have access to all of the research information. And in fact, in most institutions, that's a requirement of the contracts between the funder of a clinical study and the institution. It's one of the things that the medical schools and the universities have required. But I think it's important to remember that the reason that we have as vibrant a research industry and as much improvement in longevity as we do in this country is the relationship between our academic institutions and the companies that are actually commercializing the knowledge that the academic institutions are generating.
Dan, you want to comment?
Well, I would point out that Billy Tozen, the former congressman who's head of Big Pharma, last year or the year before said, how can we stop getting bad publicity for the pharmaceutical industry? And he answered his own question saying, let's stop doing bad things. Many of the activities in the pharmaceutical industry, I think, really go against the grain of scientific integrity. Let's recall that 2 years ago, the director of NIH, after some consultancies were found there by members of the staff that hadn't been revealed to the administration there, prohibited any dealings by NIH staff with pharmaceutical companies. He even went down to the level of saying they can't even have any stock holdings. His suspicions were so great.
And what that does is it says that NIH can't draw upon the skills of people in academia who are doing a variety of research, some of it funded by NIH, some of it funded by commercial interests. If I were trying to design a study or making a medical or a product approval decision, I would want to know that the people designing the study, the people advising me, were current on all of the research and involved in and knowledgeable about that research. I think it makes sense to be looking for people with the best skills and then to try and build some structures to make sure that there is disclosure of relationships so that people evaluating those recommendations can balance the recommendations from one person and another person. That's, in fact, why when I go to the doctor and get told I need an operation, I often say I'd like to get a second opinion.
Well, I think Marjorie stated... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, Ira, this is Eric. I would like to comment. You know, it seems to me that the real impact here is I think everybody recognizes that these relationships run the gamut of things from being related to research, and they're kind of different than research than relationships that are related to education. And they're kind of different than the relationships that are kind of related to just marketing university products. And I think everybody recognizes and knows, we know from studies that these relationships have benefits and they have risks. And I think the key is to establish policies which get the benefits and protect against the risks. And they're not a single class of environment for of relationship. And doing, you know, an all-out ban, in my opinion, at universities wouldn't be a way to go. We don't know. We haven't evaluated the impact of the NIH ban on relationships. We don't know what impact it's had. Certainly pharma doesn't know, and I'm quite certain the NIH doesn't know. So I think we really need to think about these things in terms of what they're intended to do. Mm-hmm. And just a case in point, you know, in my mind, there's absolutely no rationale for why, you know, over 80% of clinical departments in medical schools receive money for and food and beverages from drug companies for their faculties and their staff. I mean, food and beverages, that's not research. I do a little bit of research, and I don't ever recall requiring a Coke and a bagel to do some research in education. I have a master's degree in education, and I don't ever recall my professor saying to me, now the first thing you do is hand out sodas and bagels from the companies whose products you're about to teach your students about. So if we think about these things in terms of what they're intended to do, you know, it becomes clearer about what should and shouldn't be done with relationship to each of the individual type of relationships.
Well,
that
you're
exist.
You're just reflecting what goes on in typical doctors' offices, where the staff gets lunches, the doctors get dinners, they get speaking fees, they get money for clinicals, putting patients in clinical studies, things like that. They're just starting it at an earlier age for your students. Welcome to the real world, you know.
Right. Well, they're clearly demonstrating it. You know, we know a recent study found that approximately a third of medical students get one gift or attend one industry-sponsored lunch every week. Now, we don't know if that's good or bad, but we certainly know it's occurring, and it's very frequent.
Marcia Angel suggests, and she's written a lot about this relationship, she suggests a couple of steps, different things that could be done. And one of them is that institutions, she says, should not accept grants with strings attached. Investigators should design and analyze their own studies, write their own papers, and decide about publication. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with what, David Korn?
I don't think there's anything wrong, and I think it's exactly what I said a few minutes ago, that faculty who put their names on publications, regardless of who funds the study that they're reporting, have to have had full responsibility and accountability for the study from the inception to the writing of the paper, to the publication. That's a very strong value that my colleagues and I believe should be the standard. And I believe that if, and we believe that if every academic medical institution would enforce its own university policies on academic and research integrity, one could make a major step forward in getting rid of ghost authors and ghost research managers.
1-800-989-8255. Let me go get a call or two. We're running out of a timer. Stephen in Linden, New Jersey. Hi, Stephen.
Yes, hi. How are you?
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead.
You know, there's a very simple solution to this problem that I think Americans don't want to face. And that is, do Americans want to pay for this? And then we can exclude the drug companies altogether in terms of the research and the responsibilities associated with it. But I think not. I think they don't want to do that. And I think that Americans want Rolls-Royce medicine for Volkswagen prices. And that's what we've been moving to for the last 20 years. Now, one of your guests mentioned something about trials being done in third world countries. And that is true. And I think everyone wants accountability. But I think what he failed to mention is the flip side is that trials are also done in first world countries. A lot of these trials are corroborated in Europe, in Japan, in Australia, and other countries that have great faculty and great facilities for doing these kind of tests. I think what we should do is we should look at this in the broad spectrum of things. I think that we don't even look at our government with this kind of a microscope. Lobbyists in general are paid, basically paid bribers. So my thing is, if you can stop it at the governmental level, then you'd probably be able to stop it at this particular level. But I do think that we are missing a big picture here, and I think that this is part of a broader spectrum of American life. And
okay.
I do think that we should look at it more so, we should scrutinize our government the same way we're scrutinizing the pharmaceutical companies and the things that are going on, because there are a lot of things going on in our government that are associated with the lobbyists and what they're giving to our government officials.
All right, Stephen, thanks for calling.
Ira, yes. This is Eric. I think my comment would be very simply that the American people, you're already paying for it. You're paying for all of this in the form of the increased drug prices that you pay every time you go and fill a prescription.
Actually, Ira, it's important to remember that the drugs that we take, those pills that are saving so many lives or improving lives, are 10 cents out of every healthcare dollar. The largest portion of the healthcare dollar goes to a variety of other services, physicians, hospitals, laboratory tests, and it's the medicines that are in fact keeping us out of the hospital and saving some of those extra healthcare dollars and allowing us to live better. And I think it's also important to remember that the clinical trials need to be designed according to FDA requirements, and that imposes a requirement on manufacturers as they're trying to develop new medicines to be actively involved in designing the trials. If all of the academic medical center researchers did only their own design trials, there wouldn't be people to help with the manufacturer-sponsored trials that are necessary to get new drugs approved.
I need to remind everybody, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Any reaction?
Ira.
One at a time. We'll get you in there.
Ira, this is David Korn. Let me make a comment in response to that. The system we have in this country, whether it's the best or not the best, is one in which the federal government supports primarily fundamental research that no private entity is going to support because the knowledge that's created is not cannot be owned by one or a few people. It's general knowledge that all can share. There's no one else in our society whose function is to produce generalizable knowledge. But this flip side of that is that the government is not funding industries. It is not making products, probably with the one exception of the Defense Department, which does fund products. When knowledge is generated, we have a system in which the private sector industry has to step forward and take those discoveries into products, tests, tools that benefit society. That's the system we have. The relationships are vital. they have to be principled.
All right, let me get some other comments because we're running out of time. Who else wanted to jump in?
I think one of the problems is that none of the sectors, that is the government, the university, the journals, the industry, have really lived up to their responsibilities. Dave raised the issue before of honorary ghost authorship, as it's referred to. There were hearings in Congress 25 years ago in which ghost authorship was described and deplored, and the universities and their associations, and probably his own association too, said, well, the university should not engage in that. And here we are today talking about the problems of ghost authorship. I mean, why don't universities crack down on this? They have it within their capability. But many of them are quite lax and limp when it comes to looking after scientific integrity, though they are very, very vigorous and effective in chasing money.
Mm-hmm. How would you fix the system then? In a minute or two that we have left?
Well, I think you could say to the faculty, you will not participate in ghost authorship, and if ghost authorship comes to light, as it did with the Vioxx paper, there will be sanctions and there will be consequences. At present, there aren't.
Mm-hmm. I would agree. By the way, this is David Korn. I would strongly agree with Dan on that point. I think the universities have it within their power to change some of the practices that we've been talking about that are really deplorable.
Do we need standards for all of them to follow so that someone doesn't say, well, if I don't like the standards of this university, I'll go to the next one?
It would be beneficial to have the universities in harmony on this, but these are not very, very complicated standards or prohibitions that have to be put in place. They're really quite simple. If you have a financial relationship with a commercial organization, this can be put into a database on the campus that's accessible by everybody so that if some hanky-panky is going on, at least there will be a possibility of it being disclosed.
All right. We're going to have to stop there. I want to thank all of you for taking time to talk with us today. Dan Greenberg, a science journalist and author of Science for Sale, The Perils, Rewards, and Delusions of Campus Capitalism. Marjorie Powell, Senior Assistant General Counsel for the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. Eric Campbell, Senior Scientist at the Institute for Health Policy at Mass General Hospital. He's also Associate Professor at Mass General and at Harvard Med School. David Korn, Senior Vice President for Biomedical and Health Sciences Research at the Association of American Medical Colleges. Thank you all for talking about this very important issue with us today. Our program is produced by Karen Vergoth and senior producer Annette Heiss. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our producer for digital media. Shuman Ma is our intern fellow. And Josh Rogerson is at the controls and is our technical director. If you'd like to write us, send your letters the classic mail way to Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, room 306, New York, New York, 10036. Better yet, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com where we're podcasting and blogging. And Flora's got a brand new video up this week. You might want to take a look at it. We're looking for your videos. Send us ideas. Maybe your students like to make videos in their classrooms of what's going on in school and their science clubs or in the science fairs. Have them make videos and send them to us. We'll give them some airing on a Science Friday website. Also, if you're in Second Life, go over to the Science School. There are folks still milling about there, and we'll continue to. And you can check out, have a conversation with them in cyberspace. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.